From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in June of last year, when then-Attorney General Jeff Sessions used a Bible passage to justify President Trump's immigration policy. The policy led to the separation of migrant children from their families at the southern border. The chapter, Romans 13, had been used in the past to defend slavery and oppose the American Revolution. And Sessions said, quote, "I would cite you to the Apostle Paul and his clear and wise command in Romans 13 to obey the laws of the government because God has ordained the government for his purposes," end quote. Now, American historians have pointed out that referring to the Bible in political speeches is nothing new, but using scripture to enforce federal policy is. It's a step taken by several White House officials under the Trump administration. Some members of the group Americans United for the Separation of Church and State say they have seen that practice happening more frequently in the last few years. Now, Americans United has long maintained that the separation of church and state is not a partisan issue. Freedom of religion, they say, is a principle that people with all political backgrounds and parties and religious backgrounds should hold dear and should separate from the act of government itself. We'll discuss that issue this hour with Rob Boston, who is a senior advisor for Americans United for Separation of Church and State. He's also the editor of Church and State magazine. He's in town for a presentation hosted by Americans United of Rochester titled Separation of Church and State, Where We've Been, Where We Are, Where We'd Like to Be. That's at 7 o'clock tonight. You know where it is? It's at a church. It's a downtown Presbyterian church. We've got a smile out of you there, Rob. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Well, thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure.
7 o'clock tonight at the downtown Presbyterian church, and it is open to the public. What do you want to tell the audience tonight? What's the focus tonight?
Well, I really want folks to understand the urgency that we're facing right now, the threats to separation of church and state that are coming from the Trump administration, from some state legislators. Let folks know that this is a serious issue, but that we are working on shoring up that church-state wall as best we can.
All right. And so let's hit this point right at the outset of this program, because I think it probably behooves both you and me, Rob, to kind of hit this point, because some of our listeners might say, well, where's the balance on your show today? You know, where's the someone who doesn't want separation of church and state? Or I don't mean to laugh at that. I mean, I understand there's different perspectives, but also to the notion that those would think, our listeners might think that your organization itself is partisan. It's not meant to be at all, right?
No, not at all. In fact, legally, as a nonprofit, we're not allowed to be partisan. We're not allowed to engage in electioneering or anything like that, and we don't. Now, the interesting thing about this is, if you look at this issue from an historical perspective, I would argue that it's a conservative principle. The idea that there should be a distance between religion and government, that the church should not control the state, that the state should not control the church, that seems to me to be a pretty conservative principle. For folks who don't want government telling them what to do or having a heavy-handed presence in their lives, having the government enforce a kind of religious law would seem to cut counter to that.
So listeners, this hour we're going to talk about a number of different issues, policy debates, things that are happening right now at the national level. And if you want to weigh in, either challenge some of what you heard or ask questions or make comments about some specific policy debates, yes, we'll talk healthcare and more this hour. You can call the program. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program, connections@WXXI.org. I'd like to start, if we could, at a place where I saw you had some recent comments about the Attorney General, William Barr. And if you don't mind, I'd like to start there because there's a lot of different directions we'll go. But you raised some of the Attorney General's own comments from the past, in the past several decades, that it doesn't seem that he has repudiated in any way. And you had some concerns about that. And this will be new to some of our listeners. Why don't you tell us about some of your concerns about the Attorney General?
Absolutely. When William Barr was named, the name was familiar to me, and I remembered his tenure during the first Bush presidency. And at that time, he had given a number of speeches that were, you know, kind of controversial, attacking the idea of secular government. Now, obviously, as an advocate of separation of church and state, whenever anyone's coming after secular government, that's going to concern me. And I should point out, when I say secular government, I don't mean hostile to religion, attacking religion. I mean neutral. A state that is basically neutral on religious matters, allows everybody to make their own decisions, but doesn't take a perspective. So here's Barr sort of in the 90s giving these speeches attacking that. We tried to get that out there and bring that to light. Unfortunately, the emphasis on Barr was so much on the Mueller investigation and the Russia situation that that just kind of sucked all the oxygen out of the room. Everybody wanted to know, is this man going to be truly independent? Is he going to stand up for the people or be a, you know, a puppet of the president? Other issues just kind of fell by the wayside. But that was one I think should not have fallen by the wayside, because you're talking about the highest law enforcement official in the land basically not respecting one of our basic principles, secular government.
And let me highlight a couple of things that Rob highlighted in a recent piece about what William Barr has said in the past. That number one, when it comes to advocates of secularism, he had said in the 90s that, quote, advocates of secularism are clearly fanatics. And multiple times and multiple occasions, he advocated for, quote, God's law, as if there is one sort of God's law. I mean, as if that is an identifiable one thing to all people.
That's really what concerned me the most. Whenever I hear anybody talking about imposing God's law, whether they be a conservative Christian, a fundamentalist Muslim, you know, even a fundamentalist Hindu and a Buddhist, and there are such things, when I hear that type of discussion, it concerns me, because what that person is really talking about is not God's law, it's their interpretation of what God's law ought to be. Same as when we hear people sometimes say, we need a society based on biblical values. What they're really saying there is biblical values as I define them. And that can vary from person to person, denomination to denomination.
Why do you think William Barr would think of secularists as clearly fanatics?
Well, yeah, when we look at secularism, there's a legal principle and there's a cultural principle. The idea that the government shall not have a religious perspective or have an opinion on matters, that's one thing. But there is a cultural phenomenon of secularism that's out there as well. And I know that some folks in the conservative Christian community feel that, you know, culture has become too secular, that it's not as religious as they would like it to be. So, you know, giving him the benefit of the doubt, that may have been part of what compelled him to say those things. But still, the concern is, I think, legitimate.
I actually think that is a pretty accurate. I don't want to speak for the Attorney General. I certainly couldn't do that. But I think you're being not only generous, but I think you're probably on the mark there. That I think if William Barr were in this room, he would say, look, I'm not saying that every person should govern based on one religious text, but, you know, we've lost some of the underpinnings of Judeo-Christian values, and that matters, and that there's an erosion of those values, and that we've become too far down the road of secularism to lose some of those values. That doesn't carry any. I mean, do you give him any ground there on that?
I can understand where he may be coming from. Obviously, I disagree. I think that there are folks in this country who are very disturbed by demographic and cultural changes that are underway in the nation. When you think about, you know, despite some of the recent steps back we've had during the Trump administration, we've had a number of rights movements in this country over the past 50 years, the civil rights movement, the women's rights movement, the gay rights movement. And now we're seeing non-believers step up. And by some accounts, the so-called nuns, you know, people who say they have no religious belief, are 25% of the population. That's a lot of cultural change for one country to digest over a short period of time. But I would just say to folks, you know, we have to learn to kind of get along together and live side by side. And diversity is not a weakness. Diversity is a strength.
So when he sees the nuns, for example, when we're not talking N-U-N, we're talking N-O-N-E, people who are just do not identify with any religious affiliation. Sometimes you hear some hand-wringing about the rise of the nuns. We're still not in any sort of majority or plurality situation there, right?
Well, no. According to the recent Pew data, they account for maybe 24-25% of the population. So obviously they're still outnumbered by Christians. Now, what is interesting is that is a community that has consistently shown pretty spectacular growth, even over the past, say, 20 or 25 years, going from the single digits to 25% of the population. Now, another thing to understand about that community is they're not all atheist or agnostic. Some of them are, but a lot of them will say, look, I just don't have a tie to a specific faith group anymore. I'm spiritual, but not religious. You hear people say things like that. Mm-hmm. So there's a seeking there, an honest search that is actually part of our American legacy of people having that right and that power and that ability to do that.
It's interesting. We're talking with Rob Boston from Americans United for the Separation of Church and State. And so let's find out what you would have said to William Barr if you were questioning him before he was even confirmed, for example, or if you had him in front of Congress recently. I mean, obviously, the focus was on the Mueller report, as you say, and his notes on the Mueller report. But what are the kinds of questions that you think Congress should have asked him?
Well, I think right off the bat, one of the questions to ask is, what is your view of the separation of church and state? Now, notice I didn't say, do you support it? because people will say they support it, but then they have a view of it that is really quite different than, I think, what...
That reveals maybe they don't support it?
Yeah, more or less. So what is your view of it? How should it? How should church and state interact? And then get into some very specific questions. You know, can the government give funding to religious institutions? Should our children be compelled to take part in religious worship in public schools? How are we going to survive and prosper as a nation when we have all these different religious and non-religious perspectives if the state seems to have a favorite perspective? Some really pointed questions along those lines, I think, would have been helpful.
So in the same way that if someone professes to be a feminist and says things like, well, I support women's rights, I just don't want them running workplaces, they kind of give away the game, right? So what are the things that give away the game to you when someone says, no, of course, I support the separation of church and state. I just think X. What do people tend to say?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, I think that we need to get back to our godly foundations, or I think we need to have more of a presence of religion in public life, or I don't see any problem with religion being used in public institutions and government and schools and symbols being displayed. As I think it's still somewhat shocking for a lot of Americans to hear someone attack the principle of separation of church and state, because that goes back to Jefferson and Madison and the founders, whom, of course, we all revere. So people will sort of claim to support that principle. Politicians will sometimes, but then say things that really undercut it.
I think, frankly, the rewriting of history of what our founding fathers thought about deism and theism has not been all that helpful for the way we view modern government.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I sometimes when I read the writings of Thomas Jefferson, especially, you know, who took the New Testament, cut out all the references to Jesus' divinity and the miracles, pasted up what was left, and made his own little private devotional. Jefferson's views were so outside of the Christian mainstream that I really don't think he could be elected to any public office today, because his views were just, as he put it once, I am a sect unto myself as far as I know.
Now, that whole, the story of Jefferson cutting out the references to Jesus's divinity, as far as we know, not apocryphal, seemed to have actually happened.
Oh, no, the Jefferson Bible, which is on display at the Library of Congress, an amazing document, which you can actually buy copies today, says a lot about the mindset of Jefferson, who believed in Jesus as a great moral teacher, but not necessarily as a divine figure.
Yeah, frankly, a very interesting philosopher, someone who had a lot of important values about helping all people from all backgrounds, not giving favor, but maybe not thinking of him as actually divine. And you're right, if he were running today, maybe disqualifying.
Right, and we have to remember, too, we shouldn't deify the founding fathers, because obviously they came from a mindset and a time quite different than our own, had a lot of views that are abhorrent to us today. But on issues of religious liberty and the state's interaction with religion, you know, they came from a time where they had seen what that had done in Europe, the wars, the violence, the persecution, and even in the colonial period. We had a lot of that here on our own shores. That informed their view and informed their desire for separation. They were hostile to religion and wanted to shut it down. They just knew that if religion got control of the apparatus of the state, bad things would follow.
All right, so closing the loop on William Barr, if he would go, if he went in front of Congress and he were asked about those past remarks in the 1990s when he talked about secular fanaticism and wanting to see more God's law in government, if he declined to repudiate, to refute what he had said before, do you think he should have been basically passed over for confirmation?
Yeah, I do. I think that's disqualifying. I think having views that are essentially those of a theocrat, so to speak, and I don't use that term lightly, I think that is a disqualifier for public office, especially the nation's top law enforcement official.
Whether it's William Barr, though, or anyone else, they could realistically say, look, you cannot separate someone's religious beliefs from how they might govern. Not entirely, anyway. I understand what you want to do is not to give favor and not to persecute other religions, but a person who's elected to office has their values sort of underpinned by religious belief, by maybe family and society, and it's a mix of all of these things, but you cannot separate religious belief out of that. How do you expect to do that?
Right. That's a good question. It comes up a lot. And I think what we need to understand is that in our secular democracy, our secular republic, the laws need to have that secular basis. Now, that doesn't mean people can't bring a religious motivation to the table. If you think about the civil rights era, for example, a lot of the people who were involved in that cited the scripture, cited the Bible, talked about the beliefs of Jesus. brought that to the table, that was fine. But there were also people bringing to the table a lot of non-religious arguments, basic decency, fairness. This is what we're compelled to do, working together. And I think that's what we need to keep in mind. Can you really articulate a secular rationale for what you want to do? I've been following some of the spate of the recent anti-abortion laws that are passing around the country and been disturbed, frankly, by some of the things I'm hearing politicians say, talking about this is what God wants, making those references to God's law. Do they have any secular reasons for what they want to do? To go back a little bit beyond that, we can look at the battle over same-sex marriage, marriage equality. I think one of the reasons that they lost in the court of public opinion is that they could not argue any secular rationale why this policy should not be upheld. Now, at the Supreme Court, it was decided on other matters, equal treatment. But nevertheless, the opponents of marriage equality were always making religious arguments, referring to the Bible or something a religious leader said. It just isn't persuasive in a secular republic to a lot of people.
But on the subject of abortion, if a member of Congress comes out and says, I'm an atheist, I oppose abortion rights because to me that still should be viewed as murder and I'm not okay with that. Is that more acceptable to you than someone who is a member of Congress who comes out and says, I'm a Christian, and this goes against everything that I stand for as a Christian to allow abortion and I want it gone?
All right. Well, at the end of the day, you just have to look at these policies and say for a number of things. First of all, is there a secular rationale? But even that doesn't mean that the law is going to pass muster. It may still be bad public policy. It may still be dangerous. It may still run afoul of other sections of the Constitution. But at least there, we know we're not dealing with someone who's trying to impose a type of religious law on all Americans, which under our First Amendment should be a non-starter.
Let me interject to make sure I understand that. So what you're saying is, if there's an argument regarding any policy, if the only argument in favor of a certain vote on a policy would be a religious one, then you've got concerns there.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, okay. Yes.
So absolutely. So if there are secular grounds for opposing or supporting, maybe there's more there, but even then you want to explore just how valid they might be under the law.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay. That's I think that's a fair enough sort of test. And do you think we are in a place now where we see more members of Congress or policymakers at all levels who are sort of nakedly willing to just say, yep, this is, I'm a Christian, I'm whatever your religious background, and that's why I'm going this way, as opposed to trying to cloak it in some sort of kind of sustainably secular idea?
No, I think you're right about that. I think with the rise of the religious right in the 1980s and into the modern era, there are more politicians who will take that perspective and just sort of embrace the idea that they believe that the law should be based on some kind of religious understanding, usually a conservative Christian one. But, you know, it's interesting, though. This happens across the political spectrum. Let me give you an example from the other side of the equation.
Sure.
I often hear people talk about the need to address poverty, and they will cite, you know, Jesus' teaching. So they'll cite passages from the Bible.
As Jefferson might have, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I appreciate, you know, that's fine. I understand why they're doing that. But at the same time, I'm a little uncomfortable when it comes from the left, too, because I think, let's imagine a world where there was no mention of the poor in the Bible, where Jesus never said one word about it. Would that mean we could just do nothing about them, let them wallow in their poverty, not help them? I don't think so. So we have to understand that our policies, no matter what they are, no matter what problem they're designed to address, can't just be passed because we think Jesus said that he'd like for us to do it. There's more to it than that. We are motivated, I think, by ethical, moral, and legal and political concerns, but not necessarily religious ones.
Listeners, I will specifically ask you if you think there are any issues of the day that fall into these categories that either concern you, motivate you, or otherwise. And yeah, we're talking abortion, healthcare, as they fall sort of under this debate about the separation of church and state. It's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. How good or not do you think the education is in this country and what separation of church and state means, what it's supposed to mean?
I think we need to do a little bit of work on that, to be honest. First of all, I do want to say, you know, folks need to understand the literal phrase separation of church and state. That's not in the Constitution. That was a letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote where he evoked that metaphor of the wall of separation between church and state to describe the effect of the First Amendment. First Amendment is more legalistically worded, so to speak. But the principle I think is firmly ingrained therein. I mean, because the First Amendment's religion clauses are a little legalistic, it was inevitable that some kind of a shorthand way of describing them would come along. And I think that's what separation of church and state does. And another thing I would say that I think folks sometimes get the wrong impression about is that somehow separation is designed to squelch the voice of religion or keep it down or oppress it. Just the opposite's true. A proper understanding of separation of church and state allows all religious and non-religious voices equal access. It doesn't preference one over another, but it allows them to make their perspective, to get out there and speak, to do their thing, but on their own time, with their own dime.
No, but you're right, though. Some of the objection to the work that, for example, your organization does is that it is drowning out religious voices or drowning out sometimes the Christian right, not always. And so one of two things is true. That's either true or that is sort of a Trojan horse for them to accomplish other means, that they don't actually feel suppressed or treated unfairly. But do you, you know, I mean, do you think there's anything to that concern that people of faith are having their voices not heard or sort of barred in any sort of sphere publicly?
You know, I have a hard time accepting that or believing that because I see so much evidence pointing in the opposite direction. I mean, look at, you know, something as simple as Christian radio, Christian broadcasting. Their presence on the internet, their ability to evangelize and speak and literally go out on street corners and spread their views, to come door to door as some groups do. There is a robust religious voice in our society that I think can't be denied. Now, there are some limits on what you can do. For example, the Supreme Court ruled in the famous school prayer cases from 1962 and 1963 that young people could not be compelled to recite prayers or read from the Bible or hear passages from the Bible as a state-sponsored exercise.
Not to be compelled in school to do
it. Not to be compelled in public schools to do that.
Right.
Now, that doesn't mean that students can't ever have a religious expression in a public school. They can pray on their own. They can meet with their friends and form religious clubs. They can read the Bible or other religious books if they happen to have some free time. That's fine. But you can't have the state controlling it or being involved in it. So there are some limits on what religious organizations can do. But as far as their own ability to spread their doctrines and their message, well, that really is restricted only by their own imagination. I mean, certainly we see a lot of religious activity in our society. I don't think there's any lack of that.
Yeah, let me get Stephen Clifton Springs on the phone because this leads into the question I was going to ask you is, you know, what rank is yours in the war on Christmas? But I think Stephen Clifton Springs will go in that direction for us. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I just was interested in, you know, what is the controlling law for religious symbols in public buildings?
Well, thank you. That's a good question. It's a little complicated, and I should point out that I'm not a lawyer, but I do work with a lot of lawyers and have written about this issue for a long, long time. But essentially, if you have a public space that's open to lots of different voices, religious and non-religious, then everybody gets a crack at that. So if a Catholic group wanted to put up a creche, and a Jewish group wanted to put up a menorah, and another group wanted to put up their symbol, you know, a Jewish group, a Hindu group, and an atheist group might come in and put up a sign. Everybody gets equal access to that space, then we're fine. That's not a problem. However, the government isn't really supposed to be in the business of erecting, maintaining, and displaying the symbol of one faith and not giving anybody else any access. So that's kind of a, I guess you could say, a quick primer on the law regarding religious symbols.
That help
yeah,
you?
Okay,
help you, Steve? Go
how
ahead.
How is that controlled? I mean, where is that written? Where is it? What law is that written in?
Well, that would
where
be
the
court's interpretation of the First Amendment developed over many decades of law. The symbols cases, you know, go back several decades. And the court has a body of law that had decisions that have come out of those rulings, and that's where we get the rules and the regulations governing symbols.
Tell us a little bit about what's going on outside D.C. with the cross.
Yes, there's a 40-foot cross in a Maryland suburb called Bladensburg that was erected originally in the early 1900s as a memorial to veterans of the First World War. Now, it's a cross, so it may memorialize Christian veterans, but doesn't memorialize the others. That's been challenged. The Supreme Court heard arguments in the case a few months ago. They're expected to hand down a decision probably by the end of June. And I was actually in the court for the oral arguments. It was very interesting. But this is kind of an unusual situation because you're talking about a historic structure. So the court may find a way to save it on the grounds of saying, well, it's historic. We wouldn't necessarily do something like that today. We wouldn't use a cross to represent all veterans today, but that's what they did in 1919, and so we're going to give that a pass. I mean, as I say, I'm not a lawyer, but that's my guess. Now, that wouldn't be my preferred outcome, but having listened to the arguments at court, I think that's probably the way they're leaning.
Okay, and we're going to find out when?
Probably by the end of June. Court goes out of session usually at the end of June, and they tend to save the most controversial decisions for the very end, and then run out of town.
And so, and before I pivot to some other issues here, let me also say, yes, I was a little cheeky in the idea of a war on Christmas. I don't have a lot of patience for the idea that there is an ostensible war on Christmas, though I don't want to be insensitive to those who feel somehow that Christmas expression is snuffed out. I do think what happens sometimes, Rob, is that maybe there will be kind of an outlier case in which there is sort of a suppression of what should be religious freedom, but it's held up as some sort of very common example. And more often you'll see Tucker Carlson or the late Bill O'Reilly, who would kind of trumpet these on their nightly shows, this notion of a school that told a child they couldn't pray during Christmas season, or some sort of a display that was taken down. For the most part, when you spend December in this country, there's a whole lot of religious expression that doesn't seem to me to be trampled in any way.
Right. Let's say two things about that. Yeah. One is a lot of the complaining deals with what stores are doing, and stores are not subject to government policy and dictates. They can put up whatever decorations they want if they decide.
Or use whatever phrase they want.
If they decide to go a more secular route, that's their business. The second thing I would say about that is that when it comes to public institutions, especially public schools, I do remember during Bill O'Reilly's reign where he was making a number of claims and there were stories being told, and I just decided to look into them. And what I found was that in every case, relevant facts were left out or the story was essentially hearsay. Somebody heard something was going on in a school and they ran with it and they called Fox News and it's on the program that night. So there were facts left out or things made up, to be honest, that fed that narrative, but didn't necessarily prove to be accurate.
Okay, that's very, very interesting. Let me read an email from Millie who says, Evan, when you introduced your guest regarding the separation of church and state, you made a small joke, almost as though it is obvious that everyone believes in the separation of church and state. However, as someone who was brought up in a conservative evangelical Christian household, I can tell you that is not the standard belief. We were taught that separation of church and state was intended by the founding fathers to prevent the state from meddling in the church, not the other way around. We were taught that it is the church's responsibility to be involved in the government and to bring moral restoration to America and thereby salvation. From Millie.
Yeah, well, that's a good point, and I thank her for sharing that with us. I do hear that a lot. I hear that coming from very strong fundamentalist communities. Not all fundamentalist communities, but certainly a number of them. And I guess I find that kind of shocking, but there is a certain percentage of the population that has been arguing that separation of church and state was not the intention of the founding fathers, that we were meant to be a Christian nation. Now, when people say that to me, though, my first response to that is, well, that's interesting. Where does that appear in the Constitution? Because if the Christian nation had been the intent of the founding fathers, they would have stated that pretty upfront in the Constitution, and they don't say that. In fact, the Constitution makes no references to Christianity, Jesus, or God.
But I think that their rejoinder to you would be right, but the phrase separation of church and state also does not appear.
Right, but you do have the provisions in the First Amendment which have that effect, and language at the end of Article 6. Again, don't want to get too like a law professor on you, but there's language at the end of Article 6 that guarantees that there shall be no religious test for public office, meaning that you can't be forced to believe certain things as a condition of holding public office. That is a strange provision to put in the Constitution of a Christian nation. Guarantees Jews the right to hold office, Hindus, Muslims, Buddhists, and atheists.
When we come back from our only break of the hour, we'll get more of our listeners' feedback. You can email the program, connections@wxxi.org. If you'd like to call the program, 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. My guest is Rob Boston, who's a senior advisor for Americans United for Separation of Church and State. He's the editor of Church and State magazine, and he's in Rochester this hour as a guest of essentially the local chapter, Americans United of Rochester. He has an event tonight, 7 p.m. at the Downtown Presbyterian Church, open to the public, titled Separation of Church and State, Where We've Been, where we are and where we'd like to be. Again, that's 7 o'clock tonight at the Downtown Presbyterian Church. We'll get that break and come back to more of your feedback next. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation with Lloyd Glick, the father of Jeremy Glick, one of the passengers who died on 9/11 on Flight 93. Jeremy was part of that small group of passengers that rushed the cockpit, trying to regain control from the hijackers. He's being inducted posthumously into the Rochester Jewish Sports Hall of Fame, and he's a University of Rochester graduate. We honor his life next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Teresa writes to say, Evan, various elected officials have had this quote attributed to them over the years, but it precisely sums up my feelings on this hour's topic. Quote, each of us put our hand on the Bible and swore to uphold the Constitution. We did not place our hands on the Constitution and swear to uphold the Bible, end quote. I'm sure you've heard that many times, Rob.
Yes, I have. In fact, one of the individuals who said it was my representative in U.S. Congress, Jamie Raskin of Maryland.
Okay, so Rob's very familiar with that. And Teresa, thank you for that. And I just want to say, kind of following up on Millie's previous email, I didn't intend at the outset to laugh at the idea that anybody would oppose separation of church and state. I take it absolutely, Millie, that there are plenty of Americans who feel exactly the way your family expressed to you, that they do not see separation of church and state in the same way that, for example, Rob Boston and Americans United views it. But if you feel that way, and I'm not saying Millie does, but anybody who's listening, sure, let's have a conversation. Let's talk more about how we think, you know, laws ought to be constructed and the kind of conversations we have. And I remember when Barney Frank said that it was easier for him to come out as a gay man than it was to come out as an atheist, that in this country you got a better chance of being elected. Now, obviously, a lot's changed since the start of his tenure. But I'm curious to know if you think that formulation changes at all in 2019.
You know, that is a really interesting issue because I've been following the polling data on that question. And people are routinely asked, you know, would you vote for, you know, fill in the blank for president? And they'll put in a woman, an African-American, a Jewish person, what have you. The two groups that routinely scraped the bottom were atheists and Muslims. However, they have both recently cracked 50%. Now, that's, people might think, well, that's still pretty low, but it used to be a lot lower. So I think tolerance across the board, even among the non-believers and so on, is gradually getting better. And part of that is simply by people, just like in the gay rights community, emerging from the closet and making their presence known. And it's hard to hate somebody if you know them personally. That's happening with the non-belief community as well.
People coming out as atheists.
Yes, exactly.
We've had a couple of conversations in the last 5 years on that subject, and maybe it's time to revisit that. And listeners, if you know someone or if you've been in that position yourself, I would love to hear your stories, and you can email me directly if you'd like, edawson@wxxi.org, because I think that is a very interesting conversation. And occasionally it can be difficult or even risky for people in terms of family relationships, jobs, et cetera. But let me get Jane in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Jane.
Evan, it just seems so simple to me. Maybe I'm oversimplifying it, but I've just always thought of the political realm as the public. That involves all of us. And so the solutions and answers we come up with hopefully satisfy a good many of us. It won't satisfy everyone. Then the other realm is the spiritual and the religious, which to me is very, very private. And it's sort of everybody's responsibility to search out their own answers and find their own peace and understanding about the world. And I think I thought, like when I was going through school, I always felt intruded upon when we had to read the Bible in front of the class and be forced to get up and read that Bible. And it's not because I wasn't searching. It was just that it was my search, and I didn't feel like I wanted that pressure to approve or go along with it, but there was no choice. And I was telling Megan that when these things get too crazy, and they're kind of crazy right now, at least in terms of abortion as far as I'm concerned, you get to the point where we really make donkeys out of ourselves by hanging witches. We've had that in our own country, where you have arbitrary decisions about who's a witch and who's not. So it can get that crazy. But I'm pro-choice. Thank you.
Jane, thank you for the phone call, as always. What do you make of her thoughts about that experience as a person in school with that pressure?
Right. Well, that's, you know, very heartfelt and I think first-person account of the problems that we have when school officials or government officials take it upon themselves to encourage children to take part or pressure them to take part in worship. Another thing to consider is that isn't just a violation of the individual student's right of conscience. It is a violation of parental rights. You know, one of the most important jobs parents have is to instill their children with some type of moral instruction, whether it's a religious or a non-religious philosophy. That's the parent's job. When a school interferes by substituting some other faith, that's just simply wrong.
How comfortable or uncomfortable are you with how the Supreme Court handles the separation of church and state?
Well, right now I have a lot of concerns. The Supreme Court has been drifting, I think, from that principle for quite a long time, mainly due to a number of conservative appointments. And right now I think we're on the verge of seeing a lowering of the church-state wall because the court has an operational five-justice majority that's pretty conservative. You know, when Justice Kennedy retired, I mean, he was certainly not perfect on these issues, but it was a blow because on some issues he had stood pretty strongly, especially on the idea of right of conscience and not having any students' right of conscience violated in public schools. And he was a supporter of LGBTQ rights as well. So it was a blow. And now I think we're moving into an area where some of these questions we thought we had settled, they may be reopened.
It's interesting you bring up Kennedy. I was going to ask you if, to help bolster the notion that this isn't just a partisan divide, or it should not just be a partisan divide, if there have been conservative justices who you would point to say, look, whatever their personal beliefs, they have really worked in a way that indicates a respect for the separation. Justice Kennedy came to mind first for you.
Kennedy comes to mind somewhat, but actually I would point a little bit more at Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who was an appointment under Ronald Reagan. And she spoke, again, not perfect on our issues. So she was a little weak on some of the funding concerns, which are something that we've worked on a lot over the years. But essentially, she spoke very strongly and oftentimes very eloquently about separation of church and state. In one of her last opinions before leaving the court, she observed, and I'm paraphrasing here, speaking of the separation of church and state, that there are people, she acknowledged that there are people who don't like that system and they want to move to something else. And her question was, why would we want to do that when we can see the fruits and the benefits of it here? The people who want to get rid of it really have a challenge why you'd want to do that. And I think that was a very strong statement. And someone I would point to as, you know, generally a conservative justice who was really on our side most of the time.
Right now, Democratic presidential candidate Pete Buttigieg is talking about increasing the number of justices on the Supreme Court. And the critics have said, well, you do that when you're down in the game. Is that a good principle for all points in the conversation? Would you support that?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think a lot of people would be surprised to hear that you can even do that. But there have been points in history when the Supreme Court did not have non-justices. And, of course, students of history know about FDR's attempt to pack the courts. Yeah, it's a concern. I kind of go back and forth on it. I mean, the thing that concerns me about it is, let's say we did it, and then 10 years from now, there's a conservative president, and he puts, you know, seven more on. I mean, where do you stop? I think what we need to do really is get out of the mode of rubber stamping. Right now, we're in a mode where the Republican Congress is essentially just rubber stamping all of these Trump judges. Remember, the House doesn't play a role. It's only the Senate to advise and consent, and they're just pushing those through. That's the one thing that's actually getting done in Washington right now. The government, a lot of the government is ground to a halt because of the divide between the House and the Senate. But the Senate is just pushing these judges through, and some of them have some pretty out there opinions in my perspective.
Back to your phone calls, and this is Matthew in Fairport next. Go ahead, Matthew.
Yeah, hi, Evan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
There was a comment from someone earlier saying that, you know, a politician says they put their hand on the Bible and swear to uphold the Constitution, not the other way around. Mm-hmm. So I am an elected official for the village board in Fairport, and I'm also a fairly out atheist. And I can tell you, I did not put my hand on the Bible and swear to uphold the Constitution. I put my hand on the Constitution and swear to uphold the Constitution. I think there's definitely a misconception out there that everyone who is elected is working from a religious kind of moral framework. And there are other moral frameworks out there that are, I would argue are just as valid.
Okay. How have your colleagues reacted to either some of your more out positions or your interest in not putting your hand in a Bible for you? We just got an email, Matt, from a listener asking, Rachel wants to know, why are elected officials ever sworn in on religious documents like the Bible? How's it gone for you, Matthew?
So my understanding is that you get to choose what you're sworn in on. I actually had a Unitarian minister administer my kind of my casual swearing in, and the mayor of our village do my more formal swearing in. And what I was told is you can swear to any document that you want to, even a comic book. I did not choose a comic book, but, you know, the fact that you have that freedom to swear on whatever, you know, work has importance to you, you know, you don't have to be sworn in on any religious text. That's what I'm saying. It's a misnomer. It's a misconception that I wish more people knew about.
Okay. As always, thanks for the phone call, Matthew. Rob, you want to add to some of that?
Yeah, just to say he's right about that. The practice of swearing on Bibles, that's just a tradition. That's something I think, you know, George Washington did it and everybody's been following suit. You don't have to.
Yeah.
There are some Muslims in Congress right now, and a few of them have signed or taken the oath of office on a copy of the Quran that had been owned by Thomas Jefferson. It's held by the Library of Congress, and they'll bring that out. But you could do it on a Buddhist book or a Hindu book, or if you're a non-believer, on some other type of book, or the Constitution, which I think is absolutely awesome to sign it on the Constitution.
Should the word God be on our currency?
I don't think so. I mean, people may hit me for that and say that's radical and that's extreme. That stuff goes back to the 1950s during the struggle with so-called godless communism and the Cold War era. That's when they codified a lot of that stuff. They changed the Pledge of Allegiance.
Because a lot of people will think it goes way farther back.
It does not. The founders did not advocate for that. Remember, our original motto was E Pluribus Unum. And some of the first coins had a phrase on them that was said, mind your business. So it wasn't this God stuff. They slipped that into the Pledge of Allegiance. They codified it for use on currency, and they made In God We Trust the national motto in the 1950s.
Jillian writes to us to say, I've got a problem with the vast amount, the majority of songs, in the winter concert at my grandchildren's school as Christmas carols. Is this justified, and what can I do about it? My argument is that there are plenty of winter or fall songs that they can use without using highly Jesus-oriented songs. They frequently do Hanukkah songs as well, but my take is that there should be no religious songs at all in public schools, from Jillian.
Yeah, I think that's probably going to be a bit of a tough row there to get rid of them all. I do think a holiday concert, a winter concert, should have a good mix of things, you know, religious, non-religious songs from other traditions. If you really feel that the concert is tilting heavily in one direction, too Christian, you can get in touch with our attorneys, and we may be able to help with that. We've done that in some other cases. The case law in that area is, it's an old case. It's from the federal appeals courts, but we can help. So folks can get in touch, and we can see what we can do.
All right, Jack in Greece is next on the phone. Go ahead, Jack.
Oh, hi, Evan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, Evan, I very much appreciate the topic. I apologize if I'm going to repeat something that's been said because I just picked it up on the radio. But I did want to comment. A couple of thoughts. One is it's so important to re-educate the public on the separation of church and state. I'm a lifelong Catholic. We love our faith. But obviously the Catholic Church, like any other religion, they have beliefs that might not align well with, you know, current law. But I remember, not to go off track, but I read the book Adams by David McCulloch, and I remember he just had a paragraph in passing where John Adams made the comment on how sad he was. He was, of course, a Christian. How sad he was how the Jewish people were being persecuted because there was such a small minority in the United States, especially at that time. But that stuck with me, that here's a founding father of our country, second president of the United States, making the comment on how sad he was that Christians just weren't open-minded enough, but they persecuted the Jewish people. Our ancestors came from Europe to get away from persecution, religious persecution, and we seem to have lost total track of that. I hear, you know, we have evangelicals that I've seen, you know, listen, they essentially seem like they voted a block, 80% or more tend to vote one way, whether it's on gays or you name it. And it's so divisive, we can't seem to make progress as a country to move on and accept and include others.
Jack, can I just offer one observation and get your take on it?
Sure.
I think when you see polls, the way we think about people who hold different beliefs or people from different political parties, we are more suspicious than we've been in a long, long time. I didn't see polling in the late 1700s, and I'm sure there was some ugly stuff written in the papers and the journals of the time, but people seem to think that if you're a Christian, you know, if you're an ardent Christian and you're talking to an atheist, you're more likely now than probably any time in our lifetimes to think that they cannot be a moral person, that they are not trustworthy, that you wouldn't want them teaching your children or dating a son or a daughter, and vice versa. And it goes all across lines. So I think that's some of what it is, don't you? Where it's like we think people who are different than us are just either not trustworthy or not intelligent or don't have good values.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so sad. We just can't seem to step back from that. There's been some anecdotal. I don't think they're anecdotal, but there's comments that, for example, Republicans trust Russians more than they trust Democrats, and it's like, wow. You know, we have such hate. It's almost like we're back to the Civil War days in some way. At least we're not shooting each other, but. You know, it's sad that, yeah, absolutely. If we're not the same of the same tribe, whether it's religion or political party or you name it, we just don't trust each other. I agree with you. I've been around a long time, and we've had some terrible divisions in our country back in the Vietnam War. I can recall the protests and the country getting divided and split And right now it feels worse than ever to me, at least personally. That's my opinion, that we're more divided.
Jack, thanks for the phone call. I really appreciate that. Rob Boston from Americans United for the Separation of Church and State. Go ahead.
Yeah, we do have to face our history. We have to face it honestly. We have had incidents in the past, and they've continued to the present day, of anti-Semitism, of Islamophobia. One thing I might recommend that folks do is look up something that George Washington wrote to the Jews of Newport, Rhode Island. The Turo Synagogue Letter. You can Google that. It's an eloquent statement of religious freedom coming from our first president, making it clear that in this new country, everyone's rights were going to be protected. So it didn't matter if your group was small. It didn't matter if it was unpopular. Your rights were going to be protected alongside the majority. That's the ideal. And that's what we have to keep striving for, even in the face of, you know, being pulled back or conflict, tension. It bothers me, too, to see our society as the state it's in right now. But we have to have kind of the long game and understand that we can overcome this period.
And so in our last few minutes here, what either issue, policy, so what's on the horizon right now that concerns you most?
I think the attempt to really redefine what religious freedom even is. There are folks out there trying to turn that into an instrument of discrimination. The right to deny people services in stores, the right to deny their health care, to treat them like second-class citizens. That is alarming to me, and that's something we're fighting in the courts and trying to fight in Congress and state legislatures as well, but it's definitely a concern.
But you said earlier this hour that, you know, when it comes to the language and the behavior of private businesses, that's up to them, but you seem to be concerned that they might sort of weaponize how they view religion to either deny service or deny...
Right. I mean, how they celebrate a holiday is up to them. They don't have the right to deny service to entire classes of individuals. I mean, I think we would have settled that with the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Yet here we are, people arguing today, well, I don't have to serve members of the LGBTQ community because it's against my faith. I don't have to serve non-believers. I don't have to serve single moms. I don't have to serve a couple that's cohabitating. Whenever we open that door to religion-based discrimination, we're going to eradicate a lot of the work we've done in that area. We need to be very careful about that.
And let me just ask you to kind of at least try to understand the current president a little bit here. Again, it's not a partisan organization, but this is a strange case where he's very clearly not a religious person. He doesn't read at all, and boasts of this. I'm not offering this as pejorative. He doesn't read, so he's clearly not read the Bible. But he waves it around at rallies and has convinced a lot of very religious people that he is some sort of harbinger of good things. Maybe because they view him as a vessel to get things done. I don't know. How do you view that weird, that strange relationship?
Well, the hypocrisy factor here is just staggering. That they would sign off on this man's moral behavior when they have constantly attacked other politicians for things that are, you know, not even remotely close to what Trump has done. It's essentially a political bargain. You know, he's giving them what they want. I talked about those judges earlier. That's a big thing. That's huge. Some of the regulations that they're changing, without even passing laws through Congress, they're just changing regulations at the federal level in ways that the religious right finds favorable.
And I think a lot of it's abortion.
And abortion, the rhetoric.
I mean, and they're close here. I mean, we're almost at a point where the state laws that are passing are going to force the Supreme Court to take it up again.
That's what they're trying to do, absolutely.
And they've really put themselves... And if you are an American who wants to see... the top of your list of issues is abortion, and you want Roe overturned... This maybe they view the ends justifying the means with this president.
Well, yeah, I mean, they've essentially adopted that. That's not from the Bible, as we both know. but there are people basically doing whatever mental gymnastics are necessary to approve this man as their savior. It's remarkable. I just wrote an article for next issue of our magazine called The Not So Magnificent Seven, which is about the top seven evangelical sycophants for President Trump: Franklin Graham and Paula White and Jerry Falwell Jr., folks like that.
Hmm. But, you know, if you're an evangelical Christian who wants to see abortion gone in this country and you view it's millions of lives, you might say, he's not perfect, but nobody's perfect. But look what we got out of the deal.
That's what they're saying.
It's a very interesting situation. And I want to thank Rob Boston, Senior Advisor for Americans United for Separation of Church and State. He's the editor of Church and State magazine, and he's in Rochester as a guest of the local chapter and event tonight. It's open to the public, 7 p.m. at the Downtown Presbyterian Church. You can meet Rob there. Thank you for being here. Appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
All right, short break. More connections coming up.